So, welcome to the Privileged Man podcast. For me, today's guest is one of the most inspirational men I've met, and I've met quite a few. International rugby player, Oxford graduate, Harlequins player and coach, that then climbed the ranks of City to become a star trader. He had it all, but it all came crashing down at the peak before a remarkable recovery. I'm thrilled Ken Bray is with us today to tell his extraordinary story. So Ken, welcome to the Privileged Man podcast. How are you feeling today?
First of all, Pete, thank you very much for asking me. And how am I feeling? We had a quick chat about this just prior to coming in, and I'm nostalgic and a little bit emotional. We are in Parsons Green, and the first apartment I bought is a stone's throw away from here on New Kings Road. And it's bringing back a lot of memories involving going to Harlequins for training. A very good friend of mine, Peter Winterbottom, lived around the corner. A very good friend of mine, Richard Langhorne, who tragically died when I was 30. He lived on Wandsworth Bridge Road. Drank a lot in the White Horse across the road. So there's mixed emotions coming back, but by and large, yeah, really, really good stuff, but also reminds me that time has passed and it was, I'm getting a bit older.
So how old are you?
I'm 60 in May and I'd like to think I'm in pretty decent shape physically, mentally and spiritually given my age. And it's been a robust, colourful journey to date, and I believe the best is yet to come.
Good stuff, I'm sure. So tell us a bit about the highlights. From perhaps when you left Australia all the way through to perhaps the peak of your career, and then we'll get into the last sort of 15 years or 10, 15 years after that.
So, Queensland country upbringing, great. Lost a brother when I was 16, which was very, very challenging. I've reflected on that a lot in recovery in the last 8 years. I left school and became a lawyer. I didn't like studying law, and I certainly didn't like practicing it. I only practiced for 18 months. I did that to please my parents, who put myself and my two older brothers through private school. Worked out, I played for Australia under 21s, played for Queensland, played for New South Wales. Worked out I wasn't going to play for the full national team. So then I saw a varsity game on TV, and I applied for and got a scholarship to Oxford University. So we're talking about the highlights here, Australian under 21s. Amazing, to wear your country's jersey. When I look back on my life, I've had a lot of unique, rare experiences that I'm really, really grateful for that not everyone gets to do. And I'm really grateful for that. So to walk through the hallowed halls of Oxford University, it's just a real privilege. And it wasn't lost on me, even at that time and even looking back. And certainly as an Australian, to walk those halls and to study there and just have that experience. And of course, to run out at Twickenham, playing in the varsity match.
Amazing. And for context, who was playing in the Aussie 21 team and the Harlequins team and the Oxford team? Maybe, yeah, that some of the listeners may know.
Yeah, so certainly we go back to Queensland. When I played for Queensland, I was in the Queensland squad with the likes of Michael Liner, John Eales, Tim Horan. When I played for New South Wales, I played against the British Lions in 1989, and I didn't play test rugby. I played Australian under 21s, but I wasn't a full wallaby, didn't play for the full national team. So on that day, I would have been one. I might have been the only one on that field who hadn't played international rugby. So there's David Campese. I played fly half. Scrum half was Nick Farr-Jones, Phil Kearns, Simon Poitevin, da-da-da-da-da. So, and then when I went to Harlequins, Harlequins in the early 90s when I arrived just about provided pretty much half of the England national team. So iconic household names like Jason Leonard, Brian Moore, Paul Ackford, Peter Winterbottom, Mickey Skinner, Will Carling, Simon Halliday, David Pears, Andy Harriman. And I have always said that once someone said, was asking about my rugby career, and I said, I was phenomenally lucky to play with some truly, truly amazing rugby players. Clearly, I was okay as a player, but it was just a great experience to play with those guys, yeah.
Amazing. And so from the rugby pitch, and then you moved into trading? Was it just with City, or did you have other? Did you work for other companies as well?
So I turned up, and Harlequin's very well connected to the City. So I had a couple of interviews. Had one at Tullet in Tokyo. When I say interview, I had three, I think, 5-hour lunches, and they offered me a job, money broking on £12,000. And I went to R.P. Martin's, another broking company, and there was a guy called Graham Burkett. And Burko and I spoke for 20 minutes, 18 minutes was on rugby. And then he said, how much have Tullet's offered you? And I said, 12 grand. And he said, 18 grand, start on Monday. And I said, okay, fine. So I was at R.P. Martin's for 4 years, and then a job came up at Citibank. And this was a real fork in the road for me, because this was an opportunity to get into trading where, honestly, you can earn a lot of money. I had two sets of interviews at Citibank. The first six interviews for a job that I didn't get, I got down to the final two. They rang me up a few months later and said, come back for another interview. And I had another six interviews. And I just want to tell this quick story. On the sixth interview of the second lot, so that's interview number 12, I'd worked out by this stage that they would ask a question at the end of the interview and say, have you got any questions for me? The interviewer, so this particular day, I think it was a Thursday afternoon, about 3 or 4 o'clock, and the interviewer said, you know, and this is interview number 12, right? And I really want this job. And I'm, you know, it's touch and go whether I'm even sort of up for getting it, so to speak. And I said, yes, is the cleaner anywhere near this room? And we were in this glass room in Citibank at the Strand, and the interviewer just said, is the cleaner anywhere here? And I said, yes. I said, yes, clean. And he said, no, it's clean. Why would you ask that? I said, because with all due respect, I've been interviewed by absolutely everybody else here. I said, I'm playing for Crewe Alexander. You're Manchester United. I just want a game. The offer came in the post the following week. And I started 18 years at Citibank. I rose through the ranks. I was a foreign exchange trader. To last 18 years at a major bank as a foreign exchange trader, I would say demonstrates testimony to my trading ability. I rose to the level of director until a great experience working for a great bank, you know, working in Tokyo for a bit, working in New York, accumulating wealth, security. I loved it for a long time, but unfortunately, the wheels came off in spectacular fashion towards the end of that 18 years.
Well, thanks for giving us the background. So you've just alluded to the wheels coming off.
As I talk about this podcast, I highlight it being speaking the unspeakable. And I think that this topic that we're about to dive into is something that is simply not talked about. And in the wider scale, if the statistics are right, that 2.7% of the UK population are regular users of cocaine, and you then say, well, okay, it takes a certain amount of money to use cocaine, then it would say that the percentage within probably males, I'm not going to count out females here, but probably males with the finances to back it, the percentage of users is probably much greater than that in the City. I think that the UK is the second largest user per capita of cocaine to Australia. So this is a topic that is, I just want to really open up, because we know statistically and we know through our own experiences that cocaine is very widely used. And we've both got our own experiences of how that's affected our lives as well. But Ken, do you think you could just take us through the journey, maybe from your first line to your last line and how that looked? Because it's seen as a recreational drug. And that's how a lot of people use it. But I'd just like to sort of track the journey, so maybe the listeners can see where they might be on that journey too.
That's great. That is great question. Some great commentary there. So funnily enough, I took my first line of cocaine at Harlequin's Rugby Club, and it was not with a rugby player. I'd stopped playing. I was coaching, and a very good friend of mine who was a businessman, who used to, you know, hang around the rugby guys. He was a friend, and he's a friend to this day. He's got a certain amount of guilt about giving my first line of cocaine, given what happened to me, but we've talked about that. So, and I remember saying to him, he said, do you want a line of cocaine? And I'm a risker. I left a small country town to go to Brisbane. I left Brisbane to go to Sydney. I left Sydney to go to Oxford. I went to London. I was quite prepared to move countries. I was quite prepared to throw in my law degree to look for something else. I had tried marijuana, weed in Australia. I tried some pills. Nothing landed with me. So I said to him, oh, I've never tried cocaine. Can I get addicted to this stuff? And he said, no, mate, you'll be right. We'll say he was 50% right because he did it and I did get addicted. So I had my first line and I do remember thinking right at that moment, I remember thinking, wow. I do remember thinking that. I thought, wow, this is different. This is good. But it took about 10 years to get hold of me in the sense of I would use once a month. And then when you look back, it is so obvious the journey. Once a month turned into every weekend, turned into Friday, Saturday, Sunday, turned into. And then I was just increasing the amount that I was using. And you're right. You know, if you're up in the city and you are earning very good money, all the vices come into view. Right now, for me, the cocaine use was there. It was available. And I absolutely believe what you're saying is right about up in the city, there's more pronounced use, profound use of it. So I am then, as my career was progressing, I'm using cocaine, and there comes a point. And that point is crossing into the line of addiction. So I call it 1 minute the dog is wagging the tail, next minute the tail's wagging the dog. So I was using cocaine recreationally, and it was just a progressive illness. And then I remember I got a text where this guy said, drug dealer, said, we are 24/7. We will deliver anywhere, anytime. And I started getting cocaine delivered at 9 o'clock in the morning outside Citibank at Canary Wharf. There's a direct correlation between the fact that I was struggling with life. So it looks like this. Late 40s, in a country I don't want to be in, I was done with England at that point, with someone I don't want to be with, my ex-girlfriend. We were having it was a toxic relationship, the mother of my children, and doing a job I don't want to do. The stress of being in the city for that many years had taken its toll. My coping mechanism was cocaine, and I would not speak to anyone. And this is a really, really important message, is I refused to put my hand up because I was filled with guilt, shame, remorse, and embarrassment. Add on pride and ego. I'm doing the man thing. The man thing. Like, I'm not telling anyone because it's a sign of weakness. I'm going to be cast in a sort of a disparaging light, or et cetera, et cetera. Just to give context of money and consumption, I was doing 20 to 30 grams of cocaine a week. So at the height of it, on some days that would be 6 grams of cocaine. Now, for anyone who's never done cocaine, you know, if you put that in alcoholic terms, that's about 30 to 40 bottles of wine a week. And the reason I was doing it was because I was addicted. I was addicted. I just had this physical and mental craving. I was doing 80,000 pounds a year on coke. And there were some years, to give some context about where I was on the financial ladder, there were some years my total compensation went into 7 figures, right? I put in excess of 600,000 pounds up my nose in that time. And obviously there's consequences to all of this. I lost 5 stone in weight. I was mentally very, very fragile. Obviously this wasn't a positive impact on my relationship with my ex-girlfriend. So I was unraveling very quickly at the end. At the end, I was descending at quite a rate of knots, physically, mentally, and spiritually.
I'm sure. And thank you for sharing all that. Was it just something that was brushed under the carpet? Were you just great at being able to brush it under the
carpet? Right. So I didn't use with other people very rarely. I was a massive, because I knew it was wrong. You know, my parents raised me with a good, strong moral and ethical code, and I knew right from wrong. When it was gone from social to extreme use, I just became very, very, very secretive. The interesting thing that when I look back on this, there's two guys I worked with. One guy I worked with for 15 years. When I got clean and sober, we went out for lunch and he said, mate, you look so much better. And I said, look, I've got a story to tell you. And I told him a story about rehab and everything. And I said, mate, when I was on the desk and I lost all that weight, what was everyone thinking? And see, there was this strong profile of me, and that was harlequins, you know, Oxford Blue, athletic guy, da da da. He said, mate, we thought you were doing triathlons, right? And we are sitting at lunch and I burst out laughing. And I said, mate, I've never seen a triathlete look like they're the walking dead, you know what I mean? So there was this profile around me and I was massively secretive. So, yeah, bizarre and hard to understand, but that's the truth.
Wow. And also at home, what was the, how are your kids and, you know, your ex and how did it affect everything at home?
Isn't it amazing? As soon as you go there, it's tough. It's a tough to look back on. I think there was codependency. Let's first of all with my ex. And look, I want to make one thing very, very clear here, right? I have no blame. I've got my ex. I was self-inflicted. Yes, we were having a very, very challenging relationship, but I have to also look at what I was bringing to that relationship. I was a drug addict. You know, I was a drug addict. I was addicted. And I absolutely believe that you don't fully understand addiction unless you've been one yourself, because it's totally irrational and unreasonable. You're a rational and reasonable person. You're not going to do 20 or 30 grams of cocaine a week because that would be silly. That would be stupid. That would be irrational. Addicts do it because they're divorced from, they're just addicted. They're divorced from the concept of being reasonable, being rational. So the relationship was unraveling quite poorly. She, again, believe it or not, did not know anything about the coke and the weight loss, but I think the codependency was she was happy, you know, like she wasn't working. When I say happy, she wasn't, you know, she didn't work, big house, car, money. There was kids in private school. So I think that she was happy with the circumstances, albeit not happy with how the relationship was going. With my kids, the thing with the kids is that because you're not doing, so alcoholics drink in front of everyone, right? And then they fall asleep and they're stumbling and they're slurring or whatever. What I'm doing is just walking out of a room, going into a toilet, doing cocaine and coming back out. So how did it play out? I talked very quickly. I was running around the house because, you know, cocaine just raises the heart rate. And so my kids don't remember anything of my behaviours or whatever, right? What they do remember, my children are only 14 and 11, and I'm coming up 8 years clean and sober. See, when I went into rehab, they were like 5 and 3. What they do remember is, and what they see is photographs. And Pete, I look horrendous. I look sick. I look ill. And I had to have whilst we're on this subject, I had to have one of the most difficult conversations I've ever had in my life. When I started my website, you know, 8-9 months ago and started this new vocation in counselling and mentoring, obviously with putting this stuff out into the world, I had to tell my children. So I sat down with my 14-year-old and my 11-year-old, and my 11-year-old probably didn't understand, and I just said, look, I didn't go into the intimate details of the usage, but I said, look, I wasn't well, and I got addicted, and I tried to briefly explain addiction. And they see enough on TV, I think, and especially with awareness in schools and whatever, that the education they do around drugs and sex and whatever. I said, look, this stuff, cocaine. I said, but I'm really happy, I'm good today and I'm well. I'll tell you something about that, which still makes me emotional today. My 14-year-old son, who's really, really emotionally intelligent, he could see I was struggling a little bit, and he got up off the chair and he came around, he put his hand on my shoulder and he said, Dad, it's okay. Like, you're really doing a good thing these days and you're helping people. And Dad, we love you. We love you. And mate, look, you know, when you've gone to the bottom of the barrel and you're just filled with self-loathing and self-pity and you are hopeless, you are devoid of hope and I was never going to kill myself, but I didn't care if I lived or died. If you've been to that place of total despair, if you sat in that cesspit of all those negative emotions in rehab, and then 8 years or 7 years later, you're clean and sober and spending your life in a worthy cause, and your son's got his hand on your shoulder saying, virtually saying, we're proud of you and, you know, we love you. That's the journey. That's the journey right there.
And with that, we take a quick pause today to bring Monumental to your attention. Monumental is a personal and professional development platform tailored for men in their professional prime that I founded a few years ago. We're dedicated to igniting purpose, nurturing wisdom, enabling you to craft a legacy that stands the test of time. Our programs are unparalleled in the leadership development space, offering content that truly transforms lives, backed by a commitment to confidentiality that sets us apart. Explore more at monumental.global or take a scorecard in the description below. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
Yeah, it's amazing. Beautiful. God, I'm not surprised you get emotional around that.
Yeah, mate, it's kids, isn't it?
It's beautiful. So what I think you just modeled there beautifully is just how honesty for children is the way forward, right? I think a lot of men feel, particularly the ones I've spoken to along the years, whether it's work or whether it's alcohol, whether it's drugs, whether it's porn, whether it's hookers, whatever it is. I mean, don't need to go into the intimate details, but ultimately the way that you just explained it, I'm not well and I wasn't well. And this is, you know, a little bit of what happened without going into all the details. That bond that then comes with the children is just so much deeper. And the respect. And then what are the kids going to do when they grow up? They're going to tell the truth. They're not going to be, you know, I hear this all the time from parents, like not necessarily ones I speak to, but you hear it on the internet or whatever. Why don't my children tell me the truth? And I always go, I always think to myself, do you tell them the truth?
Yeah. What you just said there really resonates with me. Because I wore a lot of masks and I role played and I acted according to life's social conditioning and influences. I played the game, right? And I got told the lie of, if you have enough wealth, you're going to be happy. And I wasn't, right? So I descended and I've had a chance to recalibrate, reset and redirect. So with my kids, picking up on your point there, I want to be transparent. And I said to them that day, I said, this is an open conversation. Right? You can talk to me about my past at any time and I will be totally honest, transparent, genuine and authentic, right? Because as you rightly say, that's how I want them to be. That's how I want them to be. Like, and the other thing in there is that there's a lesson there for them that life might not go according to plan and the wheels might come off spectacularly, right? But if I can be a role model to my kids in a sense of you can recover, you can heal, you can get back on track, you can turn a negative into a positive, you can spend your life in a worthy cause. So all those things you talked about, they are concepts around truth, honesty, transparency, being genuine, being authentic, owning your stuff, being courageous, being brave. If my kids are picking up those messages from me, that's a very, very good thing.
Yeah, I love that. It's wonderful. It's wonderful. I think in this country, maybe in Western countries, there's a huge blame culture. It's the school's problem. It's X, Y, and Z's problem. But we've actually got to have far more self-awareness as parents and actually be like, you know, if your kid's not telling the truth, what's been modeled to them? You know, that's a whole nother conversation for another day. But I thought that, you know, what you were just saying there, and like, obviously you said you were an addict. And I think that that's an interesting concept because I hear a lot of people going, I am an addict. What's the difference between that? I was an addict and I am an addict.
Pete, you're good at this. You are good at this. I will say you are good at this. Great question. So Narcotics Anonymous saved my life. Right. I just want to put that out there straight away. I went in there and I had to get myself vulnerable. So people stand up and go, you know, so I say, no, I still go to Narcotics Anonymous meetings now, you know, to share my truth and honesty and share a message of experience, strength and hope. I still sponsor, mentor guys in Narcotics Anonymous and take them through the 12-step program. Keeps me humble, reminds me of my journey. So in answer to your question, I stand up and I go, my name is Kent and I'm an addict. right? Now, clearly I'm not an addict today. I'm not, you know, I'm not going to rack up after this, you know, rack up a few lines after this podcast, right? Like, obviously. So what it says is, so it's just a reminder, right? So there's this question of, am I recovered? Am I a recovered addict or am I an addict, right? And it's just, depending on who you are or how you view your program. So I never get complacent, right? So I, let's put it this way. I'll stand up in a meeting and go, my name's Kent and I'm an addict. Okay. When I'm talking to people, you know, in the real world, right, not in the fellowship, I don't want them to think that I'm using today. So I'll say, you know, I used to be an addict, right, in past tense. But in reality, in my core, I know inside me is a raging, ravenous cocaine user because I saw it. You know, that wasn't a vision. You know, I know inside me. So I still work on, there's great messages in recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous, not least of all, live your life one day at a time. One day at a time. Get up, do your best, right? So addicts go, mate, in early recovery, it's tough. Body's saying, where's my drug? Where's my coke? Mine's going, where is it? And you got to resist. Get to meetings, be with like-minded people, recovering and recovered addicts, right? And then today, mate, I can't tell you the last time I thought about cocaine. Cannot tell you. Miracle.
Yeah, I was going to ask that. Is that something that is ever on your mind? But wow, you've answered it. That's phenomenal. And I, again, just picking up on this trail, you said when you were using cocaine, you weren't a social user. It was like, this is my cocaine and I'm going to, like, you know, I remember what a selfish drug it was as well. Like, as in, like, when people would have it, it was sort of like, you know, hide it away and get quite territorial about it and all the rest of it. So I can understand sort of that situation. So you were on your own using cocaine. But the antidote to it, as you just said, was being around people who were like-minded and who were willing and able to talk about their experiences. Can you talk about, obviously, you know, this is very close to my heart. So, like, can you talk about what that meant for your recovery in not just your drugs, but your life when you started to talk?
Okay. Let's just rewind a little bit before I go into answering that question. Just give it a little bit of backstory. So I isolated, right? So I'm on my own doing cocaine. That's the vision, right? So it's me and I've got one strong relationship in my life. I've got a love affair with cocaine. I'm totally dependent on cocaine, right? I don't care if I live or die, and I'm isolated, right? So I go into a community, and this community is called Narcotics Anonymous, and I was sitting there. So I would tell people who weren't in recovery, I'm doing all this coke. And they go, why are you doing coke, mate? Stop. You've got a choice. Just stop. Well, that's crazy. Just stop. And I walk away going, mate, you don't understand. So I go into Narcotics Anonymous and they go, oh, yeah, mate, yeah, mate. Did, you know, heroin, did crack, did whatever. And I'm like, oh, okay. And yeah, I was wanting to kill myself and I was at the top of this 20-story, you know, car park and I'm looking out and whatever. And I know, I haven't been in that place. I'm not wanted to kill myself, but I know what he's talking about and he knows what I'm talking about. And I go, are you clean? I look at him, you know when someone's clean and sober. And I go, and you're clean and sober? Yeah, mate, I'm 8 years clean and sober. And I'm like, what? You can recover? And he said, yeah, you can get over it. It's not easy. And they're honest, you know. So getting back to your question, I felt immediately accepted. I thought, this is my tribe. I can tell them all my using stories. No one bats an eyelid. Mate, they've done worse. You know what I mean? But there's commitment. You know, there's focus. You've got a G-O-D, the gift of desperation. There's this guy, Dave. I love Dave. Dave's about 75, so like, should be dead. The amount of heroin he did, should be dead, right? And he said, early recovery, I was in this meeting, I was relapsing, right? I'm in this meeting giving a big sob story, right? You know, oh, I want it so bad and, you know, da, 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 da. And, like, you can't bullshit bullshitters, you know what I mean? These people, they know, right? And they can just sense it. So I walked out of the meeting and Dave came over and said, oh, mate, you know, sounds like you're in a really bad place. And I said, yeah. He said, how badly do you want it? I said, Dave, mate, I just want recovery so bad. I just want it so, so bad. He said, I'll tell you what, I suggest you do 90 meetings in 90 days, which is standard suggestion, right? 90 meetings in 90 days. And I immediately went, geez, mate, like 90 meetings in 90 days sounds a bit tough. And he goes, and there you go. One minute you self-pity, giving us a great story in there, crying and everything. He said, but the moment I ask for commitment, or suggest commitment and focus and determination and bravery and courage, you balk. And so, you know, so then that community enveloped me, loved me, right? Gave me suggestions about how to live my life and how to change my life. And that's when I realized the power of community, right? So I've gone from isolation by myself, going to die, fall into this fellowship called Narcotics Anonymous, start learning about truth, honesty, you know, 12-step program, right, which will fast forward now leads me to you. So when we made contact and we talked and you said, I've got this men's community, the first thing that hit me was community. And I know the healing and recovery powers of talking. And I know the healing and recovery powers of talking to people of a similar mindset, who are suffering from, or not suffering, who had the challenges, maybe not specifically the same, but they're all in the same ballpark. You know, they're all in the same ballpark, and it's leaving them maybe feeling less than, maybe feeling anxious, maybe feeling worried, maybe imposter syndrome, you know, bit of depression and all this sort of stuff. And that's why I joined your community, because I believe in it. And I also thought, given I'd gone to about 700 Narcotics Anonymous meetings, and also I've got a healing recovery story and message, that I thought I could add value. Absolutely believe in community and men's community. There cannot be enough of them.
Absolutely.
There cannot be enough of them, because we've just got that body, that armor around us that needs to be shed to grow and be the best version of yourself.
100%. I mean, you have given an enormous amount of value. And for the listeners, now one of our facilitators for the groups, which is epic, and I know the men massively appreciate it. Just on that, I just want to go back into where you were as a 45, 46, 47-year-old, you know, guy at the top of your financial game, with the kids, with the house in Essex, with the, you know, all the bells and whistles, but with this massive addiction. And maybe then just bring it, obviously that not everyone is a cocaine addict. It's the human experience to have ups and downs. There is not a state of euphoria, particularly in the Western world, where things like community have become a secondary thought compared to material gain, right? So I just wonder if Kent had been open to being in a community at that point, what do you think would have changed in your life?
Okay, so there was a point in time when I look back, and if I had known about, say, mentoring, or if I'd been brave enough to go to counselling, or if I had known of men's community groups, if I could go somewhere and be vulnerable and not be judged, a safe, non-judgmental, confidential space, we don't know, because I would have had to find that place before I crossed the line into addiction. Because once you cross the line in addiction, it's a bit of a different game plan. Then you've got to, Narcotics Anonymous has probably got to be the place. But prior to that, if I'd caught it earlier, I believe that I could have spoken about it, got truthful about it, sought a solution for it, got into action. And the benefits of that would have been, I would have finished off my career at Citibank. I didn't finish off my career at Citibank. I left one day, I walked in one day, I said, can I have voluntary redundancy? And the reason I said I wanted a voluntary redundancy was because going to work was getting in the way of my using. So I was on £200,000 a year, basic, 10 years ago, in a bonus, and I said, it's got to go, because I need more time to use, right? So, and that's insane, right? But if I'd caught it before then, I would have fulfilled my career at Citibank, possibly save my relationship with my ex, right? And certainly avoided an enormous amount of physical, mental, and spiritual pain. So, yeah, looking back, my message is, if you think you've got a problem, I'm saying to people now, if you think you've got a problem, speak to someone now, because if you are on that path, it will only get worse. To catch it early and talk to people, get into a community.
So interesting. Thank you for that and that download of wisdom. My experience was, in fact, as you probably is quite similar to you in terms of age, I was the late bloomer, if you like. I totally didn't see it at university. I didn't understand how people were staying up till 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. I didn't understand it. I was done by two. I was cooked, got my kebab and went home. I didn't understand. And it was so funny that I just wasn't obviously let in on the conversation. But obviously I was putting out anti-drug vibes. I mean, I clearly was at that stage in my life. And then I had a few lines in London, but it wasn't until Hong Kong where, you know, the wheels came off. And it's very speedy in Hong Kong. And that took me to a place of, as in, just for the listeners' benefit, that means that it became more like a kick rather than a high. Mm. And was very uncovered. What I was finding then was that I was becoming very anxious. And then it kicked into the next day panic attacks. So that's where my whole journey started from. And I realized at that point, I love it so much that I'm almost willing to have a panic attack for it, which is absolutely crazy. Insane. Like literally insane. But I realized that at that point that I had an addictive personality. And I was just, so I managed to basically put a lid on it. So I'm just saying, for some people who are sensitive, can be like a couple of lines and it sends you off the deep end.
I don't preach to people, right? I don't preach to people. Like, I'm very, very aware. I've got this theory. Everyone's on their own journey, right? And there's consequences to our actions, okay? But I would say, you know, if I made a suggestion, I'd say just don't do drugs. Just don't do drugs, right? But if you do and you feel that there will be consequences. Like, if you just have one line, the consequence is, you know, you're lit up for a bit. If you're all night on coke and you stay up till 6 in the morning, well, the consequences is you're going to feel like shit the next day or not go to work. There's consequences. And the more you do, the greater the consequences. But just going back to the insanity, I remember thinking, didn't really care if I lived or died, right? I got to a point. I used to sit there, my heart. So, you know, double story house, right? And I was in the spare bedroom because the relationship wasn't going too well. And I could hear this banging. What I thought was like not a banging, but a boom, boom, boom. And I thought I was absolutely certain someone was coming up the stairs, right? And what it was my heart beating against my chest plate, right? It's that loud and it's that boom, 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 right? You know what my best thinking was? I need another line of cocaine. I need to calm down here. I've got to get some more coke into me. Now, that is insanity because you're putting out the fire with gasoline. Like, seriously, I mean, how insane is that? Like, that's a great example of where the thought process is. It's totally defective. It's totally broken. So that insanity, yeah. So the message there is, if you think it's getting out of control, seek help.
Yeah, 100%. Now, talking of help, this has got you to a new life, hasn't it? It's got you to a new place where you've left the finance world, you got clean, and now you're wanting to help. Well, I won't tell the story for you. Why don't you just explain to the listeners sort of where this has got you and sort of what life you're living now?
Yeah, there's something, I'm going to come back to that. There's something I really want to add in here, and it goes to fellowship and it goes to friendship. 2015, Rugby World Cup was in England. And some mates of mine came over from Australia. And I mean, mates I'd known since I was 19. So they'd seen my whole journey, right? And they were shocked when they saw me. So they're here for 2 weeks. Anyway, they're here for a week, I think. Anyway, the 2 or 3 days before and they saw what I was doing. And they said, we want to have an intervention. And this is how insane I was. I said, what about? And they said, mate, like you are completely off the scale here, right? And there's this really good mate of mine called Troy Coker. And Troy and I, through circumstances and through friendship, whatever, played for Queensland, won a grand final for Wests in Brisbane, Oxford University, Harlequins, right? We've been all around the world playing rugby and he's seen my journey, I've seen his journey. World Cup winner with Australia, 1991. And we were walking through South Kensington about 2 or 3 days before the final and he said, he put his arm around me and he said, you need help. Please get help, right? I didn't get help for 6 months, right? My point's this. I said Narcotics Anonymous saved my life, but my journey started that night and it came from a mate. Now, I can't stress enough about, you know, when I sat in rehab, I didn't know the answer to two questions. I didn't know who I was. And I didn't know what life was about. I know who I am today. And I'll tell you right now, in my opinion, coming up 60 in May, life is about love and connection. And if you're an addict or an alcoholic or you're suffering from childhood trauma and isolating, whatever, you are distancing yourself from love and connection. And love and the connection is where the growth and the feeling worthy and relevant and loved comes from. So I don't think it's any coincidence that the bloke that planted a seed was a guy that I knew since I was 19 years old. We played a lot of rugby together. And what that is, it's testimony to friendship and mateship that that was when my journey started.
I mean, that is, it's just so important to touch on. We can live in this society of complete isolation and at times, particularly I think in the older generations of, not older generations, probably the ones who grew up without social media, put it this way, where we're like, well, it's his stuff. It's his, you know, it's his problem. He's living his life. We think his mates are looking after him. Again, we can be very geographically split compared to where our old mates grew up. But it is so important, you know, so important. I mean, you may not have seen them for years and years and years, but if you feel like someone is struggling in their marriage, someone's clearly not happy in their career, someone's drinking too much, they're not bonding with the children. Asking a mate how they're feeling is like literally what they want. And I'm saying this from a perspective of course, some men are going to resist that, but ask it twice and demand an answer because there are so many men suffering, as you said earlier, not necessarily on something that is socially normed as addiction or suffering, so to speak, or they've got a mental illness, but there are a lot of people struggling in silence. And so what you just said, Troy got you at the point of, you know, your lowest valley, but that's such a great metaphor for friendship and how it can support so many people in so many different places, right?
So he said something to which resonated, right? It came from him. It could have come from someone else. He said to me, I've spoken to him about this, and he said, oh, you know, mate, someone else would have said something too. Possibly. But the fact of the matter was him, right? And what you say, and I agree with you, checking in on friends. And if you see something, if you see their behavior changing or you see they're down or whatever, is listen. Just listen and say, are you okay? And the other thing I'll say is, if you say to someone, are you okay? Like I say, if someone's dead, someone's died, right? You can't ask them, are they okay? Here's another one. You can't tell them that you loved them. So I say to people, if you feel that you want to say to someone, certainly family, certainly to your father, to your mother, if you feel it, say it. Because I'm telling you right now, there's going to come a time where you'll never be able to say it. And if you've got arguments and distance between you and your mother and father, one of the big things I've learned about is there's a lot of grief after they've gone because the opportunity to repair has gone and that regret's there. So it's all tied up in the same sort of fear about compassion and looking out for each other. Absolutely, I agree with you.
Yeah, I love that. And there's a huge amount of wisdom in that, Ken. And I'm just going to also up the ante a bit and just to say, there's nothing wrong also with telling your mates that you love them.
100%.
And you don't have to be 2, 3, 4, 5 pints down. You know, what's the worst that's going to happen? If you tell your mate that you love them, what's the worst that's going to happen?
You know the thing about that, right? I've told some mates, and I can see they feel a bit uncomfortable. I don't care. What I'm saying is I'm speaking my truth. How it's received, it's none of my business how it's received. But I'll tell you what, if that person goes, I'm comfortable in the knowledge that he went knowing how I felt about him. So it's about me being true. We go back to truth and honesty. Yeah.
Right. On to
how quick's this gone?
Told you there's going to be a lot to get through. So look, here we are, having had, this big chat about the Kent Bray story and all of those and how it all fits in, I think, to so many people's story. Yes, it's more extreme than most, but there's so many people who are going to be resonating with this story on some level. So you've gone up to the top of the mountain. You've then come down to the bottom of the valley. You've climbed your way back up, got clean and sober. What's now what's Ken Bray part two?
Okay, so leave rehab, relapse, go to a hotel, knock myself on cocaine for 3 weeks. Don't leave the hotel for 3 weeks. Have a spiritual awakening, a moment. Say, right, I'm done. Right. So it's the 18th of June, 2016. Get offers to go back to the city, not going back. Why? The rugby chapter's finished. The law chapter's finished. The education chapter's finished. The city chapter's finished. Fingers crossed, the addiction chapter's finished. What's next for Kent? I want another vocation. I want something that I really feel passionate about. Realize that I never saw myself as a selfish person, certainly not arrogant, right? But when I look back on my life, it was all about me. Rugby, me, education, me, city, me, money, me, prestige, status, materialism, more, money, 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 right? And well, that led me to rehab. So that's not the journey going forward. So I thought, what am I going to do here? Got clean sober, made two commitments. One, to be the best father I can be to my kids. And the second one, to help people. So they explored, how do I help people? Went and studied, 2.5 year therapeutic diploma, got a lot of psychology, et cetera, and then set myself up as I thought, as an addiction counsellor. But it's interesting what the energy you put out into the world and what comes back. So now I am mentoring a lot of guys and girls in their 30s and 40s. They've reached out to me. So some of the things I do, I work at a rugby club and I mentor guys in their 20s talking about stuff like, be open and be honest and da-da-da-da-da. I work at Mind, the mental health charity. I volunteer there. That's good for my soul, keeps me humble. And some of the stuff, the trauma that walks in the door there is very humbling, and really the education I'm getting there is massive. It's fantastic. Working with a lot of, as I said, guys and girls in their 30s and 40s, and it's a mixture. So some guys, there's some people I'm working with, it's about 70, 80% counselling, 20, 30% mentoring. And some people it's like 70, 80% mentoring and 20, 30% counselling. So for someone like that, they would be, the counselling would be around anxiety, imposter syndrome, a little bit of depression. And I love it. I absolutely love it. I want to tell one quick story that happened last night. And this will sort of give you a quick flavour of where I'm at. So I had a client, first session. He had trauma. He's got trauma in his life, right? And he's struggling on a daily basis, right? So we're online. It's our first session. And we're talking away and everything. I said, look, I really need you to understand something here, please. This dynamic is safe. And safe is such a beautiful, powerful word. Safe's lovely. Everyone wants to be safe, right? So this is safe. It's non-judgmental. I will not judge you. And it's confidential, right? And I said, the last two things I want to say to you, and this is really, really important, you will be seen. You will be heard. Pete, he broke down crying, right? And I just let him be. And I said, yeah, okay, you're right. It's okay. Just don't worry about the crying. It's fine. It's fine. It's fine. And I said, can I ask what happened? Where'd you go? And he said, no one's ever said those words to me before in my life. He's 32 years old. And the feeling of just being seen and heard, right? So that's counseling, right? Now, one session at the end, I said, how do you feel? He said, oh, massive relief. We talked about it, whatever. Now, we've got a long journey, he and I, because there's deep-seated trauma. But it comes back to safety, non-judgmental, right? Confidential. You will be seen. You will be heard. And I said, mate, I'm not above you. I'm not below you. I'm on this journey walking right beside you. You never have to be alone ever again. And right, I said, we on for next week? And he's like, yeah, mate, yeah, I can't wait. Now, we've got a lot of work to go, but that lends itself to trust and faith in the therapeutic counselling. Why have I told you that story? Mate, I love it. I love what I do today. Why do I love it? Because it's fulfilling. Why is it fulfilling? Because I feel I'm making a difference. I'd like to think that I'm making a positive contribution to society. And that is the way that I want to live my life in a worthy cause.
Amazing. Just reflecting back to you, it feels to me as though you're the man that you kind of wish that you had, right?
100%.
Yeah.
100%. 100%.
Yeah, the most powerful purpose comes from the pain we felt, right?
Yeah, beautiful. Love it.
I could be reflective, actually, of that man. When I was 32, I didn't know what a safe space was. I knew judgment. I knew keeping up with the Joneses. I knew masks. Like, how many masks was I wearing at age 32? And it got me to a pretty dark place very quickly when I realized that there was just no grounding, no rooting in life. It's also been talked about, rightly so, about many men in the depths of society, the guys who, you know, you see on the streets. You know, we've got to sort out if there's mental health issues that starts to turn into what we see as the crimes, the thefts, the burglaries, you know, the assaults on the streets, that kind of stuff, which is very prevalent. But what hasn't really been talked about until likes of, you know, the Ed Sheerans, the Bear Grylls, the Charles Spencers of now sort of bringing their stories into this conversation is that men in their professional primes, like you were, there haven't necessarily been spaces that confidentiality. So if you would, I'd just like you to talk about your experience of Monumental and the Summit community that we have and how you found it coming in and then how you found it as from a facilitator point of view as well.
Okay, so the backstory here is we were introduced to each other via Dr. Phil Hopley. And we spoke and I said, I was absolutely a believer in community and it was a new sort of new dynamic. So I'd done the NA, you know, because that's a lot of, you know, drug users looking to recover. You were talking about, you know, business people, career people, people who weren't drug addicts, weren't alcoholics, were married, kids, et cetera, but were struggling with some aspect of their life, right? And I found that really intriguing. Very interesting because it just was a new dynamic to what I was used to with Narcotics Anonymous. I thought, wow, that's interesting. This is a similar community set up, people talking, people getting honest, people getting vulnerable, but in a different, you know, dynamic, right? So I joined it and it was massively, massively educational for me to see what would appear to be a well-balanced, reasonable, rational, either a person who you said in their prime, but or a person who's not reaching their prime, right? They might not have been in their prime, but they're not reaching their prime because of something, right? And when the more meetings I did through the Monumental platform, I've learned a ton of things, right, that I can take into my counseling, mentoring stuff. But not least of all, I've learned that there are people walking around there and on the surface you're thinking, this guy, like if you see a drug addict, you see a drug addict, right? But there's no indicators here. There's no indicators. This person, well-dressed, speaks well, you know, successful, whatever, and yet goes home, closes the door, and is gripped with some overwhelming sense of something. And that's what I've just found it so intriguing. I found it absolutely fascinating. I mean, we went to lunch yesterday. There's nine people sitting there. Everyone would have gone, there's nine guys over there that look like they're happy and they look like they're fine and everything must be rocking in their lifestyles. But we are addressing challenges. And I think I wholeheartedly advocate, and I'll just say this blatantly, I wholeheartedly advocate the Monumental Men's Group. I'm in it. And I can leave at any time, and I don't. And I'm there every week because I believe in it.
Yeah, thank you. So I've spoken to over 1,000 men in this kind of circumstance. Yeah. And the thing is, we all have challenges. It's the human experience. Yeah. You've talked about courage and bravery. Can you find that resource in you to actually just come out and start talking? Because as you said, it's not just about mentally feeling better. It's about how can you grow and develop so that you can reach your prime, so you can reach all of those indicators that you want to get to, whatever that may be for you personally. But marriage, kids, your family, you talked about your mum and dad, being able to be open and honest before that opportunity has gone, huge, massive game changer in my life when I actually started talking the truth about 5 years ago to them. Huge, totally changed the dynamic. So, yeah, thank you very much for sharing that. Ken, I'm just going to round things off. If people wanted to get in touch with you, how do they get in touch with you?
So I've got a website, which is getting revamped at the moment, but I've got a website, Kent Bray Counselling. I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Facebook. You know, in this digital age, I'm sure, you know, if you want to find someone, you'll find someone. And so if you're out there, you want to talk on anything, it's not just about addiction. I deal with all sorts of presenting issues. The mentoring's really taken off. And if I can have a little plug, I'm trying to get some speaking engagements. So if anyone's out there who's listened to this podcast and think that they could place me in front of an audience, which would be beneficial to that audience, then please reach out to me. So Kent Bray Counselling.
Yeah, mate. If you weren't going to plug your speaking, I was going to do it for you. Mate, thank you so much for coming in. Been brilliant.
My pleasure, Pete. Thank you.
So thank you for joining me, Pete Hunt, on the Privileged Man podcast. If you're interested in learning more about our personal and professional development platform for men in their professional prime, please visit the website monumental.global for more details.